From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, an unlikely project to plant rice in southeastern Wisconsin.
Then a Marquette researcher delves into the complicated science of gender and performance in sports.
We assume in a lot of our research when we test just men that what's relevant for men is relevant for women. But that's not always the case.
A new production by Theater Red lets women take on some juicy roles.
There's no excuses or shame or disgrace in her behavior. She is who she is. She is the embodiment of hedonism. It's gluttony and lust and the fruits of life and the zest for all the simple pastoral pleasures of the flesh.
And the challenges of trying to perform Shakespeare with no amplification in Wisconsin state parks.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Rice is one of the world's staple foods and one of the most widely eaten, especially in Asia. The UN reports that rice is the agricultural commodity with the third highest worldwide production. But for all of Wisconsin's agricultural prowess, rice has not been a crop produced here. Well, at least not until now.
As part of our full plate series on agriculture, Lake Effect Susan Benz takes us to an acre plot in rural Ozaukee County, where a Marquette University scientist by the name of Michael Schlappy, along with several students and Hmong immigrant farmers from Laos, are taking the next step in Wisconsin's rice production.
Marquette student Kristen Stannis appears both bewildered and amazed as she looks at the evolving rice paddy on what was formerly a cornfield outside the city of Mequon. A tractor moves back and forth through the field, leveling the land, while a cluster of women, wide hats protecting their faces from an intense midday sun, deftly plunk clusters of seedlings into the mud.
I think 2 weeks ago.
Great.
And we've just been planting today, just going through the motions of planting, and I guess I'm more learning about rice farming, what it takes, what we're putting in, all the efforts that we're doing. And
Stannis is a biomedical sciences student interested in business who was invited to come aboard as a project intern.
As the process moves forward, I would say just evaluating just all of our expenses, all of our cash flows, and developing it into a business model for what we're doing here.
Stannis's boss, scientist Michael Schlappy, says he was able to bring on interns, pay them, and buy some basic equipment thanks to an innovation grant from the university. Schlappy experimented with rice varieties from around the globe for 5 years, testing how they stood up to Wisconsin weather in miniature paddies he built on his lab rooftop on campus. He settled on a short grain variety from Russia. 2 years ago, he took the experiment to a farm field outside Port Washington. A story we produced on the experiment made its way as far as Vermont, where it reached the ears of a rice farmer named Eric Andrus, who today is on a tractor in this field, breaking up soil as Schlappy watches.
He sold me this machine.
The 3-horsepower mechanical transplanter manufactured in China, Schlappy is standing next to.
So we have a relationship. He's kind of my consultant. But around the same time as I got interested in this, he got interested through a workshop that he learned from a Japanese farmer in Vermont. He's actually doing it commercially now in Vermont. But he heard me 2 years ago. That's how he made the contact.
Wow.
And I think this would not be at this stage, because 2 years ago he asked me, what's next? Because you looked at the small paddies at the Fondy farm in Port Washington, remember? And we were, I mean, they were small, right? It was just more like, see if this can work in Wisconsin. But this is actually production size. So this is commercial production. This is intended for commercial production. And I could only do it with the grant from Marquette to involve the undergrads, like my interns here just talked to. I have several biology interns as well who work on this. You know, and I try to pay them well so they're happy and hopefully stay with me for the duration of this grant.
Vermonter Eric Andrus climbs off the tractor for a sec. He grows rice on 5.3 acres back at home.
Which is small by most any standard, but
We're hoping for better than 10,000 pounds of rice sales this year. So that goes a long way towards constructing my annual income. Eventually, I'd like to expand to maybe about 10 or 15 acres, but probably not beyond that.
Like Schlappi, Andres hopes to inspire others because he says there's no way he can personally scratch the surface of the demand for high-quality rice.
Michael and I have been corresponding for a while, so we've been sort of working up to this moment. And I also have a personal connection to Wisconsin because I attended high school and graduated from Whitefish Bay.
Did you?
So, yeah. This is sort of my old haunts here. And now I'm coming back here to plant rice. So it's like, my goal is to plant rice coast to coast. It's like so funny.
Andres has experience in working with farmers who know far more about rice growing than he.
In Vermont, we have a Nepali refugee community, and those people are also very passionate about rice. So I have had those folk doing work sometimes on my farm. I've attended rice events where they also attend. So there's a little bit of cross-pollination all around, and they're from Southeast Asia, not Central Asia, but a lot of the kind of the atmosphere is very similar. My hope is that we can all kind of develop this together with some ideas imported from overseas, some developed locally, and some brought in from, you know, the cultures that these people have brought with them.
Here in Wisconsin, Michael Schlappi says fruitful partnerships have helped him get this far. When he first ventured out to Port Washington, he used a bit of land managed by Fondi Market, a long-standing enterprise in the heart of Milwaukee. Fondi Executive Director Jennifer Casey has formed a relationship with Mequon Nature Preserve, where Fondi is farming space in the preserve's northwest corner.
20 acres here, and we would love to expand. We could not meet the demand for the amount that we had. 33 farmers that wanted to farm on site with us this year, just word of mouth.
So remind me what the arrangement is.
We rent the land. Fondi Food Center rents the land from Mequon Nature Preserve. Yep,
together.
And at Port Washington. Mm-hmm. We in turn rent out the actual land, parcels of land, maybe it's a half acre or an acre, to a farm family. And they also, in addition to paying for rent for the land, have access to our tractors. We do all of the tilling in the spring and then again in the fall. Our farm director, Stephen, is probably the most important resource that they have access to. And so he's on site a couple of days a week to help troubleshoot, make sure that the equipment is working correctly or if any training needs to happen. So we offer a suite of resources. Of course, we're looking at getting irrigation up and running for the entire farm this year.
The Mequon site is a mere 13 miles from the market, far closer and more convenient for Fondi farmers. Casey says she's on the lookout for more affordable land small farmers can count on one year to the next. She says the Fondi Farm's original purpose was to ensure farmers at the market had access to quality land on which to grow. She sees the rice project fitting into their mission.
I've talked to several of the farmers here today who have not planted rice or worked in a rice field for 20 years. And everyone that I've talked to is enjoying themselves, including these young men. You should definitely talk to them, Susan. I mean, I think that they could better tell you in your own words, but of course many of these ladies were growing rice in Laos before they had to become refugees and before they came to this country, before they fled to this country. And we had an outpouring of interest at the rice trial plot at the Port Washington farm. Pie, in the red there, she's experimenting with her own test plot with rice that she brought back from her sister who grows down south. But the cultural significance, I mean, rice is found in not just cuisine, but art and folk stories of the Hmong culture, the Hmong people. It's an important food. Obviously, there's the tying the community together because harvesting and planting is a communal process.
Pai and her fellow farmers are knee-deep in mud and too busy planting to pay me any attention. Chu Sang Vang and his two brothers stand at the sidelines, passing the women flats of seedlings or smoothing the soggy earth when directed to do so. Vang's parents are farmers, but they're not here today.
So what do you think about
this process?
This process right here is kind of slow, but I can see how they started when they did it in Laos and how my parents grew up doing this. So
Is that kind of a special feeling, or does it just feel totally foreign because it's something you didn't do?
Yeah. Because I come here like thinking like we're going to use a machine and all that, but then we're going to do this one by hand. So I get to know how they felt when they were doing it by hand back in Laos.
So have you tried it yourself?
Yes, I've tried. It's kind of
how's it feel?
Slimy. Really slimy. I'm not really good at it, but I'm slowly learning.
Vang is studying film and video production, but says when he can, he helps his parents, who sell at Fondi. He finds this rice planting experience, slimy or not, moving.
It is hard, but it's a little bit rewarding too, because you have to get to see them, because like I said, my parents own a lot over there, so I usually help them. So I can probably come down here and see how the rice are doing.
Michael Schlappi looks on and smiles as Vang and his brothers assist the women. They're beginning to take ownership of their section of paddy.
The section they're standing in right now, it's really wet. And they kept complaining that it's not leveled, the field is not leveled enough. But now I see them hacking, you know, they use a hack to or a hoe to take pieces from the berm and push it into the section that's not flat enough. So they're taking matters in their own hand to make flatness out. I think they want to win the context in terms of yield, which they might, you know.
That wasn't Schlappi's original position. He thought machine planted would conquer. Altogether, 250,000 seedlings were nested into the soggy earth. And Schlappi says if all goes well, it could yield a couple thousand pounds of rice. We'll let you know how that turns out. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
You can learn more about the Marquette University Rice Production Program, as well as hear all of our full plate segments at WUWM.com.
When it comes to sports performance, will women always lag behind men? We'll talk to a Marquette University researcher about her work next on Lake Effect from WUWM.
Anything you can be, I can be greater. Sooner or later, I'm greater than you.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. As the song says, anything you can do, I can do better.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Well, at least when it comes to the jobs that you and I have.
But when it comes to sports performance, things are not equal. Men are generally stronger and faster than women thanks to their physiology. But there have been claims made over the years that the longer an event goes, think ultramarathon or even longer, the more advantages women have over men.
And there are documented cases where women do beat men in ultra-endurance events. But are those exceptions rather than the rule? Marquette University's Sandra Hunter has been studying sex differences in sports performance for more than two decades, long enough to compile a great deal of data. She joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to set the record straight.
Sandra Hunter, welcome back to Lake Effect. It's great to have you back.
It's great to be here.
So the myth, men versus women, who is better, who is physically more capable, and in particular when it comes to endurance sports. So to start on the most basic level for our listeners, with men versus women, what are the basic key physical differences that each possess that either put one at an advantage or the other?
In most sports that require power or some type of endurance, the best men will always outperform the best women. Certainly there's overlap that a lot of women can perform better than a lot of men. But overall, the best men will outperform the best women. And the reason for that is that in terms of endurance, the maximal oxygen consumption and that capacity of men is much better than women, and usually about 10%. And the reason is basically because men have larger hearts, they have more muscle mass, they have more hemoglobin, which is that oxygen-carrying capacity of the blood, and they have less body fat to carry during certainly weight-bearing activities such as running. And so it's not surprising that you see around about a 10-12% difference in world records between men and women across the board, certainly in endurance events. Sometimes in events that require more power, sometimes those percentages can increase. But that's just the bottom line. And it's always going to make it difficult for women to outdo men.
Now, some growing number of recent standout performances by women in ultra-distant events has, I suppose, researchers, athletes, coach, believing that women maybe still aren't far from achieving the full potential as athletes. So you mentioned one thing is that women have more fat on their bodies, and mm-hmm. some people have said that this helps them in the extreme endurance runs to help fuel them or keep them going. And do women also have different muscle structure that allows their muscles to perform at a long, sustained rate compared to men going out hot and maybe losing steam?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So there is this theory that women will outdo men, particularly at the very long events. And there is some credibility behind that, but we looked into that with some of the research we did. We looked at the sex differences in ultramarathon distances and many of the events across America. And we didn't find that to be true on average. You know, the reality is you get less women and less men competing in those events. So you get more of these anomalies that occur. And there's other factors that will contribute to performance during those really long races, particularly if it's hot or cold, that may have little to do with the physiology of that particular person, but, you know, some spurious event. But on that topic, I did say that men will outperform women. I've done a lot of research now over the last 20 years in showing that, in fact, women are less fatigable than men if you get them to perform a very particular exercise at the same intensity as a man's. For instance, we get subjects, both men and women, into the lab, and we've noted that the women will be able to outdo men if we ask them to perform a contraction at 20% of their maximum or 30% of their maximum for as long as possible. And so we find that for these very isolated cases of arm muscles, lower limb muscles, that certainly women will outperform women. And that really is reflective of the different makeup, which what you were alluding to before, of their muscles and the types of fibers that they have, and that a lot of the makeup of the fibers of women in particular are more fatigue resistant. Women on average have more fatigue resistant muscle fibers than men. And so this allows them to, under certain conditions at the same relative intensity, say 20% or 30%, to certainly be less fatigable than men. And sometimes it can be quite stark. And I've studied that for many years now. And we've looked at models as to why that occurs, but it's predominantly due to differences within the muscle.
Now, you yourself have been in the field studying these things, but there overall is a lack of female athletes being studied compared to men, as well as how long they've been studied for. I mean, for example, we couldn't officially run marathons until the 1970s. So how does this lack of data affect things now and going forward?
Yeah, that's a really good observation. So, and I think you're alluding to, say, for the marathon where women were only legally able to compete in the 1970s, which is... I just find that interesting and shocking at the same time.
Yeah.
So there certainly hasn't been the same opportunity. And what we see in biomedical research in general as well is that there's a huge sex bias for less inclusion of women in biomedical research studies. And so as a result, it certainly puts us at risk of not understanding what the true sex differences are due to, say, physiology or anatomy, at least within the body. And that sort of goes over to diseases as well and truly understanding what diseases are.
Right. And on top of that, Title IX was implemented in the 70s, but many schools didn't feel the full effects until maybe 10, 20 years after. Some can argue
Correct.
Still today that things aren't being implemented equally. So has Title IX affected how men and women are studied in exercise as well, or in endurance sports?
I think it's been more of an awareness. There's a couple of reasons probably as to why women aren't studied as much, particularly in the exercise science that I've noted. A lot of the researchers were male to begin with, and over time that has changed, and that's certainly not always the case now. But also, there's a lot of male researchers who've come up to me, you know, in conferences and just said, I'm not comfortable with dealing with the menstrual cycle of women and it complicates things. So we just study men and we just study males. And
but does it really complicate things?
I don't think it does, not at all. And in fact, the research that we've done in my research lab has shown that, in fact, the differences across the menstrual cycle for a woman is that those differences are much less than the differences, say, between men and women, and that they're just small fluctuations and that they really have very limited effect on some of these more pertinent issues of, you know, strength and fatigability differences between men and women. And so I think it's more perception, and that you know, we've just got to start including women more than men in a lot of these studies. With this sex differences research, it's been really interesting. There's really two approaches. One is to bring men and women into the research laboratory and to understand their physiology. There's no doubt women are less fatigable, but men are stronger and faster and more powerful. The other approach is to take real-world data, performance data, and then to try and understand the physiology based on that real-world data. And that's what economists do. That's what social scientists do. They take real-world data and try and understand it. And so about 10 years ago, a journalist from Runner's World called me up and asked me if there was, and this is how I really got into this, is there any sex difference in the age at which men and women peak in their marathon performance? And I said to her, I have no idea. And the reason she was asking, because in the Beijing Olympics, the woman who won was 38 years of age, and the guy who won, the male, was 21. And there's this sort of perception out there that women may be older when they perform best at marathons. I said, I have no idea. So I got some undergrads and said, we can look at this. Let's go back and do some data mining now that there's a lot of results online and we can find a lot of information about the best runners. And I said, you've got to find their ages. In the top five runners who won these major marathons like the Boston, the New York, the Chicago, Berlin, the Olympics, the World Championships. And we also looked at the performances and we compared the best men to the best women. But on the ages and that age question, are men and women different in the ages at which they peak in their performance? The answer was no, they're not. In fact, they're about 29 years of age on average. There was a bit of a trend for women in the London Marathon and the Chicago Marathon to be a few years older as they won. But we put that down to the fact that those marathons are flatter. And if you're an older woman, you probably want to run a flatter marathon just because your power starts to go. I mean, it's the same with men, but that was what we hypothesized. But overall, there's very little age difference. But the most thrilling thing that came out of that first article and that first research study was that we compared the first male and the first female, the second male and the second female, and looked at the sex difference. And when you take the first, it was around about 11.5% difference, sex difference, which made sense. And these are the best runners in the world, and this was across about 30 years of data. But when you got out to the fifth person, the sex difference had increased to about 13%. I thought, well, why is that so? Why is the fifth best male and the fifth best female, why is the sex difference bigger here? So then we did another study and we looked at the New York Marathon data because we hypothesized that, in fact, it may be that there's less depth in the pool of runners within women because they haven't been competing as long, only since the 70s. And the interesting thing about the New York Marathon is that we're able to get age groups and we're able to get the numbers of men and women within age groups. And so we're able to look at these correlations between the ratio and the numbers of men and women within each age group and the sex difference. And we found a fantastic and really nice relationship between the number of men and women within an age group and the sex difference. And basically, the less women within an age group, the bigger the sex difference. And it explained about a third of the data. The other two-thirds of the data is explained by pure physiological differences. So I was sort of a bit gobsmacked. I thought, wow, can it be this simple? The talent pool is less because women just aren't competing at the same rate. The interesting thing in that data was that the 20 to the 29-year-olds, they did have a ratio of 1-to-1. And when we looked at that, their sex difference was about 11%. And so it showed me that, yeah, this is a real issue. Mm-hmm. If women aren't competing at the same rates and the participation is less, we really won't and don't understand the true physiological sex differences and what's relevant for women. And we assume in a lot of our research when we test just men that what's relevant for men is relevant for women. But that's not always the case, particularly if exercise fatigability is different, if there's responses to training that may be different between men and women. So it's just fascinating. It's probably a window into a much bigger issue where if women are included less in research studies in general in biomedical science, that in fact we're not going to truly understand what the sex differences are and may miss some things, particularly with our research into drugs.
So there is the gap in participation, but do you think it's because, you know, are women less or more active than men today? And in addition to that, is it because of the old myth that women aren't competitive, that our nature of competitiveness is not strongly fueled as is compared to men, or their sense of, you know, competing with each other rather?
Yeah, there is that theory out there, and it's being fueled by a lot of research. But we looked into that because I did have a colleague who approached me and said, I think women are less competitive than men, and that some of this sex difference is actually explained by the fact that women are less competitive and they're not trying as hard. And I was shocked. In fact, when we...
Could you say this with a straight face?
So we do studies in my lab where we actually measure the ability of the brain to activate the muscle. And there's zip differences between men and women. That in fact, that women are equally motivated to perform maximal contractions just as much as men are. So there's that bit of evidence. But certainly with running events, there is the possibility that women are less competitive or less risk takers. That's what we rephrased it as. Are they less of a risk taker? Now, we collected some data over 14 marathons. It was about 91,000 data points. And we compared the pacing of men and women across these marathons. So we compared how fast men went out versus how fast women went out in the first half of the run versus the second half. And those who believe that women are less competitive than men would hypothesize that men are going to go out faster because they believe they can, they're more competitive, they're going to run faster, and then they're just going to slow more because in a marathon, sometimes that happens. You sort of hit a wall and it can be almost catastrophic in terms of performance. And that women will be more evenly paced. So, and that's exactly what we did find. We didn't find it in the elite women and men. We found that there was very little difference in pacing. But the alternative hypothesis is that women also have a more robust ability to glycogen spare. And so it could be still a physiological difference. So to combat that, I said to him, well, let's study a distance where glycogen is not an issue, and that would be, say, the 10K race. So then we did another study where we looked at about 200,000 data points, and we found certainly that there was still a small sex difference in pacing, but it was mostly eradicated, and that in fact that the men and women did fairly similarly across the 10K race. So that proved to me that for at least this domain, certainly women and men have similar motivations. Now, why they do a marathon may be different, but their drive to win, their drive to compete, I think is not particularly different.
The sex difference, you know, would this term even be needed, or can we truly solve and point specifically to a sex difference until men and women are fully incorporated equally? You know, will this always be a thing to hypothesize and theorize about?
Yeah, I mean,
for the long-term future.
I suppose if there's a one-to-one ratio in competitive sports and in many things, then we'll really see what the differences are. And those differences should be celebrated, It's not like women are less than men or men are less than women. And I talk about this not because I think women are more important, but because they're just as important. And I think that's really key thing to remember.
Dr. Sandra Hunter is a professor at Marquette University's Exercise Science Program. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find more about Dr. Hunter's research at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, Milwaukee's Theater Red opens a new verse play at Optimus Theater tonight. We'll get the scoop when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
More of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Shakespeare often finds a home in American summer theater. From big professional companies like the Utah Shakespeare Festival to amateur productions and community playhouses, the Bard is indeed made glorious in summer.
In a bit, we'll hear about a local company whose mission is to produce Shakespeare in as many of Wisconsin's state parks as possible. But our next guests are planning their production inside at the Optimus Theater in Bayview. Except Theater Red's show is, well, not exactly Shakespeare.
The Wayward Women by Chicago-based playwright Jared McDerris is described as a modern verse play in Elizabethan style. It does have some very direct references to a number of Shakespeare's plays, and it has all sorts of wordplay, posturing, singing, and stage combat as well. Joining me in the studio are Theater Red co-founders Christopher Elst and Marcy Dougherty Elst, and Jennifer Larson, who plays the role of Dame Grendela. Christopher, who also directs the show, explains the appeal of McDerris's plays.
Jared's a great Elizabethan verse writer, and he wrote A Thousand Times Goodnight, which is an adaptation of A Thousand and One Arabian Nights for Elizabethan verse. And since that was our first play, we thought, oh, well, what else is Jared writing that we think is interesting? And so we came up with The Wayward Women, which we went and saw when he produced it in Chicago. And it's marvelous. It's so funny. It's inspired by Twelfth Night, and Twelfth Night is my favorite Shakespearean comedy. So it sounded perfect for the things that we like to do, and we read it and it was hilarious. We saw it and it was even more hilarious, so we said, I want to do that.
Well, and what's great about it is it features a cast of women. There are men in the show, right? The Theater Red, we do roles of substance for women, but it doesn't mean that we don't put men in our shows. So there are three men in the show there. But what's great about this cast is what you have is women in the traditional sort of male roles, or sort of that sort of gender in Twelfth Night. So you've got the character of Dame Grendela, for example, who is your combination of Sir Toby Belch and Falstaff and others, but it's actually a female character versus a male. So what's so cool about Wayward Women is you get these characters and archetypes that are traditionally male roles inhabited by women, because of course the story takes place on the Isle of Amosa, which is a island governed by Amazons, by women. So I think that was the most exciting thing, is to see this diverse range of female characters that typically women don't get to play these kind of roles.
Yeah, that was fun for me too. The idea that you can, and Jennifer, you're playing that character, the sort of Sir Toby Belch-ish character.
I am.
And women don't tend to get to be silly in that way on stage.
No, the beauty of this role, and I have to thank both Jared and Christopher for their insights and their text, the words. But not only do you get a chance to play this character that's typically inhabited by men on stage, but I have the opportunity to play it completely unapologetically. There's no excuses or shame or disgrace in her behavior. She is who she is. She is the embodiment of hedonism. It's gluttony and lust and the fruits of life and the zest for all the simple pastoral pleasures of the flesh. And she does it all unapologetically and embraces it all and spends a good portion of the production wishing everyone would just join along with her or training others up in her stead.
Which is terrific. Again, we don't usually get to see women do that sort of thing, where women tend to get stuck in some very narrow roles, even in Shakespeare. I mean, he's better, but you have to remember that all of those roles were originally played by men, so they were allowed a little more license.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I think having a wide variety of women represented in this play is amazing. So there are lots of different philosophies represented by women instead of lots of different philosophies represented by men. And all of them, especially Dame Grendela, are unapologetic about who they are. And in modern times, I feel like there's only one kind of empowered woman, whereas these are all women making their own decisions, regardless of what the societal or certainly there's no patriarchy to subdue them. So they get to do whatever they want. We see that with male characters all the time, but we don't get to see that diversity of thought and philosophy in female characters.
Is there any trick to speaking modern verse versus Shakespearean verse, or is it pretty much the same in terms of acting technique?
I think there are a lot of similarities. However, the thing I've noticed that's the most different when you're looking at modern text that's in iambic pentameter or in verse, especially the way Jared has written it, it's much more palatable, easier to understand. The words seem to roll off one's tongue easier than when one was trying to chew on Shakespeare, for example. And I think that's going to make a difference in audience enjoyment as well, because they come in going, oh, it's a verse play, it's Shakespeare, I don't know if I'm like Shakespeare, but it's actually quite easy for them because of the way the actors are delivering the lines and the characterizations of the text to understand the plot and understand what's going on.
And so the words are modern meanings too, I assume.
Does use some Shakespearean words for sure. He's an expert in original practice Shakespeare, which is something he actually taught me and I passed on to the cast. So he does have Shakespearean words for sure, but they're his own words as well. And there's so many allusions and references to other Shakespeare plays that Bardophiles are going to get a little kick out of that sort of thing. But the original practice was much more like a sporting event and was much more audience friendly. So we find that audiences, even if they aren't fans of Shakespeare, if you perform Shakespeare in this original Shakespeare practice, they do get it. It's so welcoming to an audience. And so we use a little bit of that because we know that Jared's a fan of that. So we said, well, let's just use that since we knew he wrote his play that way. And I think people are going to really respond to it in a different way than what they've normally seen with a Shakespeare play.
Any of us who took theater classes, theater history in particular, know that Shakespeare's plays were performed outside in the Globe, or a lot of them, not all of them, but outside with, you know, the people in the pit, you know, talking and throwing in, that there was like a lot of interaction. And is that what you mean by that kind of...
Definitely.
Dealing with the text and dealing with the story.
Right. A soliloquy is a direct address to the audience. And we have some songs in here that Jared wrote, one sung by our dear Dame Grendela, which we encourage the audience to respond to a question or sing along with the storyteller. And there will be definite specific points of audience interaction.
I should mention that the music that accompanies these great lyrics was written by a member in our cast, Tim Rebers, who, of course, you know as a fantastic composer and opera singer here in town. He is playing Cordelius. So he...
One of the three men.
One of the three men. Yes, the highly coveted man. So he's
the heartthrob.
The heartthrob. He arrives on the island. I've been describing him a little bit, the character a little bit, not Tim. As, you know, he comes on this island of women, and he's this handsome man that they all comment on. It's sort of this idea of all the women are like, fresh meat, kind of like, you know, new man on the island. So that'll be really cool to have that also contributed by Tim. But I think the other thing that's really neat about this play is at the Alchemist Theater, if you've been there, it's really intimate. It's one of my favorite theaters in town. It's 64 seats only. So the way that Christopher has built the production and the staging and the blocking, it's meant to feel that the audience is a part of this moon festival, is a part of the Queen's court when she comes out to address. And because it's a small, intimate house, you get that sense of just being enveloped in the story. And the characters are going to be moving around the audience and into the audience to take advantage of some of those opportunities for direct address, or when they're hiding from another character or making a kind of an offhand sort of comment. So I think that will be really immersive and fun and interesting for audiences. And I don't think there's a lot of places where you can see that kind of thing.
You know, I wish we could have gotten Jared on the phone with us next time you do a piece of his, because I would love to know, and maybe, Christopher, you know this, What is it about verse that just excites him so much as a playwright that makes him want to do things like this?
Well, I think verse allows for poetry to be a part of theatrical life. And it's not that other modern playwrights don't use poetic language. It's just verse has this entirely new aspect to it that elevates it without having to be separate from what the audience wants to enjoy. And I know that with original practice Shakespeare, he hid a lot of his stage directions in the verse. So Jared can actually visualize and create a play in his mind just by writing the verse a certain way. You know, the rules dictate that if you're saying this, you have to be in proximity. If you're saying thou, you have to be in proximity. If you're saying you or that, you're going to create a more formal distance between people. And in studying that, you create a much more intimate relationship with the text. And I find that people in modern instances, in modern theater, tend to gloss over things that they would normally just say quickly. So the sort of things that I'm saying now, or have a very modern rhythm. So when I'm talking, I might say slow, slow, quick, 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 slow, slow, quick, quick, slow, you know, or something. Whereas the verse sort of lends itself to this musicality and creates a much stronger connection to the words being said. So one of his favorite, I know he'll be happy that I shared this, one of his favorite things is he said, I saw a Macbeth, and he finally said, full of scorpions is my mind. A lot of times the Macbeth will just skip that word scorpions as though it doesn't matter. But if you think of having scorpions in your mind, I mean, that's an insane image. And in that moment, to say full of scorpions, this great alliterative word, is my mind.
All those S's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the sting of the scorpion, yeah.
Yeah, it evokes something new in you that you wouldn't get from someone just saying, I think I'm going crazy. So I think that's where verse really speaks to us. And I think of theater as being the summation of all the art forms. So if we can add poetry, then we should definitely put that in.
Well, it certainly started with poetry, didn't it? With
it
the Greeks,
mm-hmm.
at least Western.
Yeah,
Western
a little bit more
did.
Oratory style.
Mm-hmm. And Jared studied a lot of Shakespeare when he did his MFA at WIU. Mm-hmm. And it's his favorite, Shakespeare's his favorite playwright. And he just is a huge fan of Shakespeare. So part of his love of that language inspires him to write in that style. And I remember talking to him one time and he said, you know, Shakespeare's plays, I love them. They're great. Everybody loves them. But there's only so many of them. So in his mind, by creating a modern or a new verse play, it's sort of his way of trying to add that sort of play to a canon where, you know, there's only so many plays that Shakespeare wrote. So I think Jared, you know, in his small way, feels like he's contributing to that body of theater that he loves so much.
Marcy Daugherty Elst and Christopher Elst are producing directors and co-founders of Milwaukee's Theater Red. Jennifer Larson plays the role of Dame Grendela in the company's new production of The Wayward Women.
The show opens tonight and it runs through July 22nd at Bayview's Optimist Theater. You can find more information at WUWM.com.
From modern verse to the original, we'll meet the folks bringing you Shakespeare in as many Wisconsin state parks as possible when Lake Effect returns right after this. Back with more of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about a new production of a modern play written in Elizabethan verse. But if you go to some of Wisconsin's state parks this summer, you'll have the chance to see and hear some of the original. The Milwaukee-based Summit Players are producing Shakespeare's A Comedy of Errors in 16 parks, including this Friday evening at Three Bridges State Park in the Menominee Valley.
And later this month, they'll also be at Milwaukee's Lakeshore State Park, which is where I met up with two of the key players on a cool and foggy morning along the lakefront. Tell us who you are.
I'm Hannah Klapprich-Miller. I'm the executive director of the Summit Players.
I'm AJ Magoon. I'm the public relations director of the Summit Players and an actor as well.
All right. So tell us where we are and what the significance of where we are is.
We are at Lakeshore State Park down by Discovery World in Milwaukee.
I feel like we're standing here, the fog has rolled in. It's probably 45 degrees where we are. I feel like we should be talking about Othello.
Yeah, it's not, it doesn't seem like the proper situation for a comedy right now. It's a little ominous out here, and it really always is when we're at Lakeshore. It's an adventure of a park.
Yeah, and our big thing is that all of our shows are accessible, and usually the weather does play along with our mission statement. So Lakeshore is one where it is a little bit more of a wild card because the lake effect is very strong right next to the lake, but It's part of the adventure. It's part of the experience. It's always fun.
So we've talked about this in the studio a couple of times, but this is the first chance I've had to actually kind of see a space where you put on a show. We're looking, it's just an expanse of concrete and some grass and a few benches. How do you convert this wide open space without really much infrastructure at all into something that not only can you put on a play here, but people can watch it?
Well, the agreement with the parks is that no matter what location we are in, they provide us with a picnic table. So a picnic table gets carted into this space, and that becomes our levels on our stage. So the actors are climbing all over it and crawling over it, depending on what character they are.
So it has to be a pretty sturdy picnic table.
Yeah, usually. That's also part of the fun when it's a surprise, and it's not. But our shows are blocked in a way that the actors have certain set points where they're going to hit this part of the audience if they're going out into the house, or they're going behind the banner, which is our backstage. So that is very adaptable no matter what the location is physically like. And in previous years, our shows have both taken place in forests. So there are really, there's not
some
a forest.
Shrubs over there.
Yeah, some small shrubs. But when we arrive at the location, go through kind of a shorter run through of the show and hit points where we know the blocking will be a little bit more challenging depending on what the terrain is like.
How much rehearsal time do you have at a space like this so everybody's on the same page?
Well, Lakeshore, we're so lucky because it is very close to the Marquette University campus where we do the majority of our rehearsals. So we actually have come down here in the past and done a rehearsal on location. But for the most part, it's kind of a surprise. Whenever we add a new location, we don't see it until we get there. So that's, again, part of the fun. But the way that we do our shows are just adaptable. That's kind of the nature of the beast.
Your voice carries very well. But we're standing in a pretty wide open space. How do you ensure that the people who are watching can hear it?
Talk even louder. We work
on... Like I should back up.
Yeah, I can project now. We work really, really hard on projecting and on speaking loud. And it's a matter of speaking loud, but also diction and enunciation. I mean, we go through an extensive series of warm-ups before every show. We go through an extensive series of vocal exercises during the rehearsal process every year. You know, we work on, you know, we start close together and then we move further and further apart, running our lines, running the energy back and forth so that we all get a sense of how far away we are from each other and how loud you have to be heard. I mean, it really is, it's a different kind of energy to, you know, you really can't be quiet and nuanced and subtle about it. Like, you gotta be big and bold. And there have been, you know, times in the past where you gotta take care of your voice because it's pretty easy to wear yourself out basically kind of shouting that much. But we work on projection and enunciation, and we really kind of put a lot of energy into making sure that we can be heard.
A lot of actors will say that performing a musical or performing a Shakespeare show is like playing a football game, and the amount of energy is probably similar, coming
fewer
from different
concussions.
Muscles. Yeah, you hopefully,
God,
if you're
God,
doing
I
your
hope
job
so.
Right. But yeah, in spaces where there are fewer trees for our voices to bounce off of, it is just more of a puzzle as to how to let your voice carry, and kind of like, it's almost like a song. You're practically singing the play.
Well, and from where we're standing, we can see three big stages at the Summerfest grounds, or the festival grounds. You were saying one of the times you were out here, Polish Fest was going on. How do you compete with, you know, the sheer mass of sound that comes out of the festival grounds?
A lot of the time, when you get to a point where you know you can't compete in volume, you start trying to compete in diction and just making sure that every single vowel and consonant comes out, because that's really, as long as you're hitting, especially those consonants, as long as you're hitting the beginning and ends of words, people can try to kind of interpret. We did the Milwaukee Fringe Festival last year, and we were over at the Peck Pavilion, and we got to a point where there was musical performance going on behind us with amplifiers and speakers, and it was just blaring.
It was a rock concert.
It was a rock concert. And you get to a point where you go, I can't yell over this. I'm just going to be very, very articulate and hope the audience picks up what I'm doing.
Well, and I imagine the audience audience in a setting like this can roll with the punches.
The audience actually does have some responsibility in that task when they come to our shows, because we make the audience our sound effects. So they it's also their job to participate enough that they're telling the story with us over the sound or through the sound. If the storytelling, as AJ was saying, the articulation is important, but also like the intensity and energy that we're putting into the storytelling. We need to be captivating enough to keep the audience focused where we want them to be.
And honestly, we love our audience. I mean, they are with us in good weather. They are with us in bad weather. They're with us when it's quiet or when it's really loud. Like, they are an adaptable group of people when they come to see a Summit show, and we love them for it.
Well, so we've talked the last couple of years. Talk about what you're performing this year and what's special about this third season.
So this year we're doing The Comedy of Errors, which is a new play. We're adapting the script.
It's not technically a new play.
Oh, no. I mean,
it's new to us.
new to our audience. That's correct.
One of Shakespeare's latest.
Yeah, you know, he's putting out new ones.
Right. So this show is... as always, the challenge is, like, why is this show relevant? Why are we still doing this 400 years later? And the way that we're doing it this year is very silly, very fun, in the same way that we've been doing it in the past. It's also a story about immigrants. It's about falling in love and being confused by that. It's about people trying to make their livelihood. So it's a lot of, like, human things that people are still trying to puzzle out today. And something unique in terms of the style of the way that we're doing this show this year, As I said previously, our shows in the past have taken place in forests, so the set was kind of like pre-made for us. This time, it takes place in the city of Ephesus. So we're adding some more scenic elements in terms of the props and things that we're bringing along with us on tour, which is kind of a new, fun design challenge for us of how do we make a set piece collapsible? How can it be used in more than one way in different scenes? So we're making use of umbrellas, tent poles, things like that. It's going to be real fun.
This is a really interesting show, too, because the whole mechanic of the show centers around twins. That's kind of the plot device. It's these two pairs of twins who keep getting confused for each other. And they don't know that they're both in the city together. And so everyone's like, why are you? I just saw you, but now you're slightly different. You don't know what's going on. And it's really confusing. And our audience is so used to us playing different characters. When we are in different clothes, that means we're a different person. Well, now we have this added challenge of going, okay, I am a different person, but I look identical to how I just looked. Some of us are twins, but some of us aren't, and how do you, you know, differentiate that for the audience? So it's a really exciting new challenge.
Yeah, it's almost like a 400-year-old sitcom.
Basically, I mean, yeah, it's all of these, yeah, it's one of those, like, swinging doors, everyone's just coming back in and out, and you're like, what's going on?
If we had doors to slam, they would be making lots of noise in this show.
Thanks to both of you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Mitch.
Hannah Klaparich Miller is executive director, and AJ Magoon is the public relations director for the Summit Players. They are also actors in the troupe, which will perform Shakespeare's A Comedy of Errors in 16 state parks around Wisconsin, including this Friday evening at Three Bridges State Park in Milwaukee's Menominee Valley. You can find a full schedule at WUWM.com. That is all for the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow morning at 10 for Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, and keep listening because fresh air is next.